go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here we are. Yes, it's live. This is the 11th day of August, 2014. This, then, is the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That, of course, is where you go to find access to the chat room, which folks are wandering into even as we speak. Good evening, M. Brandt. Good evening, Stockton Leary. Good evening, Texas T. And good evening to the inveterate, indefatigable chat room moderator, Sparky. Good evening, one and all. More folks will be wandering by in short order. See, there's John CDN now. Hey, John. That's how this all works. Also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, of course, you will find the Listen Live player, the handiest way to go about listening to the program, unless you're on some sort of mobile device, in which case we represent, Jesus. It's Monday. In which case we recommend the apps from Stitcher and or TuneIn Radio, with the ever-present understanding that none of the ads that you may see on either of those apps in any wise were sold by or inure to the benefit of the Horn. No ads here. Nope. No, we run entirely on the goodwill and the determination of others, to wit, the Horn Family Commune Congregation, determined that we will, in fact, have independent, uncensored, freewheeling conversation. Toward that end, we try to raise $150 per evening. And this evening, we begin with an especial note. It's been a while. It has been a while since we heard from Paul from Parts Unknown. And, well, as I explained in my response, when we don't hear from somebody, the community is small enough that when we don't hear from somebody, we begin to fret. So it is in fact, it was good to hear from Paul from Parts Unknown last night, who wrote, "Sorry I've been out of touch for so long, but I've had a lot going on with my life in the past few months. However, I've been listening. I haven't been able to contribute in a while because my job was in jeopardy. I apologize for being vague about some of the details, but I need to keep up a certain level of anonymity. At the beginning of the year, my company was bought out by an even bigger company. Now, with most mergers, after a few months, the company began to synergize or eliminate redundancies, which is code for laying off workers. See, that's what happens when something like Bain Capital gets a hold of you. You get synergized, or you get redundancied, or what they rationalize. They also rationalize jobs, too." Yeah. Paul from Parts Unknown continues, "I was realistically looking at being out of a job at the end of this year. Not just me, my whole department, or possibly even the entire site. So I've been trying to save all the money I can." Wise indeed. "As the year dragged on, my department began working harder, longer hours, and getting paid more overtime. I work in the manufacturing..." "I began working harder, longer hours, and getting paid more overtime." Do we understand, and granted it's a long time since the law itself was passed, but do we understand why overtime was created? You know, time and a half? Time and a half overtime was not actually created as a boon to workers. Time and a half overtime was created to encourage employers not to work their employees like draft mules, but rather to hire more workers. In other words, what's easier, paying somebody regular hours for 40 hours or paying time and a half for, well, but it doesn't work that way. God, you gotta love the free market. But anyway, Paul from Parts Unknown says, I work in the manufacturing business, and we were pumping out tons of products to the warehouse. For a while, it felt like we were digging our own graves, creating enough of a buffer with our own production to give the company enough time to change over the work to someone else without affecting customer demand. It turned out that we were basically in competition with a few other sites, and last place got their work divided up among the other sites. Jesus, it sounds like Glengarry Glen Ross. First place is a set of steak, or is a Cadillac, and second place is a set of steak knives, and third place is, you know, you're out on your ass. So instead of losing our jobs, we have a bunch of incoming work. I would like to say I feel relieved about the situation, but I can't. I keep thinking about those other people who lost their jobs. I feel fairly guilty about someone else's loss being my gain, and I feel angry about my lack of power to do anything about it but keep my head down and keep working. I can't help but feel like there will be no one left to help me when they come for my job, to paraphrase a famous quote. And, of course, Paul, that's exactly how you're supposed to feel. You're supposed to feel alone. You're supposed to feel isolated. You're supposed to feel powerless. You're supposed to feel utterly at the mercy of the wealth capital that drives your workplace. And, you know, and exactly, keep your head down. You know, don't be out there organizing or trying to get all union-y or anything, because, well, remember, first place car, second place steak knives, third place, you're out of a job. All right. Ugh. But don't feel bad. Because this is not a creature of your making. You are not the Dr. Frankenstein who made this monster. No. Anyway, Paul from Parts Unknown continues, the good news is that I have some extra money saved up. I'm not going on any kind of spending spree, but I would like to donate a good amount of money to the Horn. So I'm issuing the following challenge, and this is the challenge that begins the week. My birthday is this week, so I would like to issue a Paul from Parts Unknown birthday challenge. For the next 3 nights, I would like to put a $50 challenge each night for Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. If all 3 challenges are met, then I will donate an extra $50 to the Horn, specifically for Bob to invest in electronics for the phone systems or surge protectors, whatever he feels would be a better investment. In other words, this is kind of geared toward the equipment fund, beat up electronics fund, what like that. On a different note, and this is some food for thought. I already gave my answer, and I'll share it with you as well. But apparently, Paul, like many of us, just sits around thinking about stuff. That's kind of what separates us from the ordinary run of the mill, say, American. Maybe that's elitist, but I think Americans of all stripes sit around wondering about their existence. The problem or the crux of the problem arises in knowing in the difference of whether or not one has the sufficient tools to be able to build the answers to the questions. If one sets out to build a log cabin with a potter's wheel, you're not going to get very far. Now, if you set out to make pottery with a potter's wheel, you're in good shape. But not for log cabins. And so it is that if you set out to understand the nature of the ongoing crisis of a failing empire like the United States, and all you have to consider the issue with are the incoherent yodelings of the teabaggers and the birthers and the deathers and the tenthers and the birchers and the booger eaters and the libertarians and the repiglicans generally, you're not going to get very far, because all they ever do is tell you whose fault it is besides you. Look, it's them immigrants. Look, it's them dark-skinned people. Look, it's them gay people. Look, it's them women's. Look, it's them liberals. Look, it's them progressives. It's that Obama.
See how it works?
Paul from Parts Unknown and the rest of us do sit around thinking about things, and here's the fun part. We actually have the relevant toolkit for doing it with. Among other things, if you're listening on a regular basis to Dr. Bill O'Brien, who returned to the air today, he'll be on the air today and tomorrow, but not Wednesday. He's got a shindig on Wednesday. Well, you would have heard the story today from Dr. Bill of... I mean, I had to get out the Thorazine Dart self-administration kit when he told this story on air. The third-grade teacher from South Carolina, Stan, who proudly called into the Flush Flimball Oxymoron Hour, 20 Mule Team Oxymoron, to explain that Megadiddos from South Carolina Rush, I just wanted to let you know that I'm a big fan, and I'm a third grade teacher down here in South Carolina, Stan, in Rush. I just want to thank you for writing these marvelous books all about how you was right there when the pilgrims landed in Pearl Harbor and saved America from the Eskimos. It's all right there in Rush Revere and the Pilgrims. And as a third grade teacher, Rush, I just wanted to let you know, you get the idea, right? Megadiddos from Busted Knuckle, South Carolina, Rush. I'd think about marrying you if you wasn't already married to your fourth or your fifth or your sixth wife living down there in that old pit you got in Florida that you keep her in.
It puts the lotion on its skin. Mr. Snurdly, I can make her life a living hell.
And so, no, really, this third grade teacher from South Carolina, Stan, was talking about what a magnificent teaching aid it was that she was able to use his two Rush Revere books. Wow. How much ego does it take to equate yourself to Paul Revere? I mean, Jesus. And she explained to him that my children were just so, I mean, they was giggling and stuff. And even though your book is not on the approved reading list, I was able to use it, Rush, in order to explain to them that slavery was wrong in America and our founding fathers eliminated it because it was so wrong. Now, by this point in time, during Dr. Bill's program, I was tearing at my hair, I was rending at my clothes. I just keep sackcloth and ashes here. But that's the kind, that's, yes. And see, if you are a member of the Horn Family Commune Congregation, then you can have the tools to understand why a third grade teacher talking about indoctrinating little third graders with That is objectionable. Wow. Because, you know, today is Moran Monday. The 11th of August, 2014. Thank you, Randy. Coming in loud and clear on my iTunes, says Randy. Much obliged. So, Paul from Parts Unknown continues. On a different note, I want to ask a question of someone that has had a cup of coffee in law school or any other folks in the Horn commune with more law school under their belt. So I'd like to ask the Horn family to come with me to Mr. Rogers' land of make-believe. Let's just say, between now and 2016, a huge populist progressive movement forms enough of a plurality to get a fairly progressive candidate to win the presidential election, and enough wins in the Senate to stop all the Republican filibustering. Now, we're not going for full-on fantasy here, because Paul from Parts Unknown is not talking about taking back the House. And we know that he's still in orbit around the same planet we are, because he says a fairly progressive candidate wins the presidential election. Not a progressive candidate, or a genuine liberal, or even saying, you know, Bernie. Or for those of you who think she would be willing to do it, Elizabeth Warren. I tend to trust Charlie Pierce when he says she ain't going to run. But anyway, a fairly progressive candidate wins the presidency, and there are enough wins in the Senate to stop all the Republican filibustering. That would be 60, mind you. It would be 60 to have a filibuster-proof majority, because math in the Senate doesn't work the same way as it does in the rest of the universe. So it's actually a reasonable hypothetical. Now let's say, continues Paul from Parts Unknown, let's say that a couple of the rats, Robert Alito, Thomas Scalia, and that Kennedy guy, either retire or get called to their long homes, and our progressive president nominates some progressive non-activist judges, you know, because they couldn't be activist judges, because then they couldn't get confirmed, because you can only have an activist judge if you're a goose-stepping, mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking, right-wing, booger-eating, birther, deather, tenther, bircher, libertarian freak. Let's say our progressive president nominates some progressive non-activist judges to the Supreme Court. Then these nominees sail through the highly progressive Democratic Senate. There's a little whoopsie. I don't think you can call a Democratic Senate highly progressive as long as it has, say, Mary Landrieu, Joe Manchin, you know. Natalie Tennant. Progressive. But Paul from Parts Unknown asks the question, even with a progressive Supreme Court, would stare decisis, also known as stare decisis, prevent the court from overturning everything from Citizens United to Hobby Lobby? Basically, are we stuck with these bad Supreme Court rulings? Thanks, Bob. More to come later. Signed, Paul from Parts Unknown. So there it is. There is a $50 challenge on the table this evening, tomorrow evening, and the evening following, in an attempt to build up the equipment disaster fund in honor of Paul from Parts Unknown's impending birthday. Thank you. Thank you, Paul, very much. Let's take a look at that hypothetical. Of course, it has to be predicated on, and, you know, really, politically, this could happen before 2016. No, wait. It's not like I'm suddenly hallucinating unicorn sparkle pony Pegasus is flying around my head. It could happen. Now, neither Roberts nor Alito nor Thomas nor Scalia nor that Kennedy guy, the Rats K, ixnay on the Rats K, are going to retire. But, you know, I mean, Fat Tony Scalia could be walking down the little street one day, whistling the Horst Wessel lead as he often does, and the goddess of irony could drop a piano on him. What would happen then? Well, the first thing is that John McCain would show up on the for-profit media, every program on every channel. I mean, he'd be on Duck Dynasty, Toddlers and Tiaras, Here Comes Honey, Boo Boo Child, Dancing with the Stars, The Price is Right, Family Feud, declaring that because of the untimely and tragic death of the patriot Antonin Scalia, the president should appoint someone ideologically similar. This would then be echoed by Senator Lindsey Graham Cracker, who, after being given smelling salts, would declare that some American city would catch fire if, in fact, that did not happen. You think I'm engaging in hyperbole, but I'm not. This is, after all, Moran Monday. And yes, over the weekend, Lindsey Graham Cracker did say that one in his White House was going to cause terrorists 7,000 miles away to burn down an American city. Yep. But that would be the first thing. And once everybody stopped laughing and assuming that, hey, you know who would be awesome on the Supreme Court of the United States and they wouldn't dare turn her down? Elizabeth Warren. Her's a lawyer after all, you know that? Put her up there and just watch her go up and tweak that little beady-eyed Roberts is right on the nose. Game on! Then, assuming you had the spine, Harry Reid could call in another nuclear option, as it's described, on the filibuster, and there you go. After all, I can remember all those years during the Bush administration when the Republican Party and, who was it, Trent Lott and, Bill the Cat Killer Frist was the primary on this. When Bill the Cat Killer Frist would stand up in the Senate and say, all we want is a up or down vote. Goodness me, mercy sakes. And so, lo and behold, the nominee could be confirmed on an up or down vote, to wit, 51-49, 52-48, 53-47. Hi! Hi! But you get the idea. It is not beyond the realm of possibility. I mean, okay, so the goddess of irony isn't throwing around a lot of pianos these days. But, you know, Slappy Thomas could always get choked on a pubic hair from a Coke can. Right? Anyway, it could happen. So then the central question becomes, are we stuck with Hobby Lobby and Citizens United by virtue of stare decisis forever? And the answer, the quick answer, the easy answer is no. No, we are not. Because sometimes, the court has the prerogative of reviewing one of its previous decisions and saying, you know, we went back and had a look at that decision in Hobby Lobby, and we have decided that the dissent in that case was correct, and the majority opinion was butt dead wrong. Or the standard they would use in the court would be to say, the decision was plainly wrongly decided. The decision itself is plainly wrong, and we hereby throw out that decision. It's been done, you know. Lochner eventually became plainly wrong, and most famously in Brown versus Board of Education, Plessy became plainly wrong, Plessy being the case that decided that, oh, mercy sake, certainly, surely to goodness, you can have a law that says the colored people have to ride a separate train coach than the good, upstanding, God-fearing, Bible-believing white people do. This is, after all, a limited decision, which then caused Jim Crow laws to flourish and promulgate across much of the nation, and particularly the South, like mushrooms after a spring rain. Right? Yeah. Well, that same standard could be applied to Hobby Lobby, Citizens United, maybe even the so-called liberal members of the court who voted in favor of sweet Granny McCullen to thrust gory pictures of fetuses in the face of women seeking health care. That could even be overturned. Stare decisis is not made of concrete, as the Roberts Court has proven via a number of decisions. Of course, we all remember John Roberts sitting in front of the Senate saying, I'm just going to call balls and strikes. And, you know, had he been made of wood like Pinocchio, his nose would have put out the eye of Patrick Leahy, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, as it grew. But it wasn't, and so he was able to sit there under oath and lie like a rug, which he did. So in short order, then, the answer is, there are ways out of this. But as Paul from Parts Unknown needs to, or wants us to understand, there are a few things that have to happen first. Cano, pubic hair, Coke can, natural processes, retirement, something like that. Of course, the greatest threat as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, the greatest threat there is actually the great advanced age of the so-called liberals on the court. And, of course, you know my position that there actually aren't any liberals on the court, because to be a participant in the judicial process is to be inherently conservative. Because if you do not if you do not follow this legal system that says, first of all, protect the money, second of all, manage the morons, and thirdly, punish the mean ones, the three M's, money, morons, mean, those are the cornerstones of American jurisprudence. If you don't subscribe to that, you're not going to go very far. So, but anyway, I hope that provides an adequate answer to a really, really thought-provoking question from Paul from Parts Unknown. Oh, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Thank you, Randy. Of course, that was 27 minutes ago. For the newbies, please say hi, I'm Bob Kincaid, Randy says. Randy stays on top of things like that for me. And a reminder, yes, there is a challenge on the table. Paul from Parts Unknown will this night, tomorrow night, and the following night. In other words, he's putting forward $150, $50 per night. Your 10 will become 20, your 20, 40, your 25, 50, your 50, if it would be 100. And thanks very much to ASA for getting us started this evening. Going back to our teacher in South Carolina, Stan, note coming in from Jim, subject line, boom. I remember a teacher in the late 70s who taught that Adolf led Germany in World War I. Told her about it, and she never spoke to me again. Oh, well. Sometimes we just have to get by in life without those folks, Jim. We just do. And it seems to me that you have made it fairly successfully. Now, it really is, no kidding, more Ann Monday. And as you can tell from the Lindsey Graham cracker smelling salts story, well, we got plenty to work with. Note came in about an hour ago or an hour and a half ago. From Jessica, noting there's never a dearth of filth on Moran Monday. No. And yes, we could save this for Wednesday, but why would you? Because we're going to be up to our eyeballs in prayer meeting Wednesday material by Wednesday, too. By the way, program note. Yeah, it's Thursday that I am scheduled to be absent, if that all works out. I'm supposed to go over and deep throat a garden hose to let a doctor look at my gullet all the way down to my stomach and make sure everything's okay that way. Because remember, my insides are all screwed up. No, I am not looking forward to it. Because, among other things, the rules are, nihil per os after midnight the previous evening, precisely 2 ounces of water with which to take my little old blood pressure pill the next morning, and then comes the anesthesia and the waking up, and the being pretty stupid for the next 24 hours while that crap wears off. I don't know yet if that's going to happen because there are some scheduling issues. But anyway, I'll try to keep you posted. But anyway, let's go out to Oklahoma, Stan, this here being Moran Monday and all. News 9 Oklahoma with the story. It's a story from Highway of Holiness Church. Yes. Why you would ever go to such a church? Well, that's not part of this inquiry, I guess. But Highway of Holiness Church has an annual event it holds every year. That's why it's annual. Highway of Holiness Church is in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, Stan. And every year they have a children's event. What was I saying earlier about not having the tools with which to deal with the modern world? Yes, every year, oh dear, every year Highway of Holiness Church in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, Stan, holds something that it calls the Children's Crusade. Now, the Children's Crusade is supposed to be a thing where they bring children, the little sinners, to Jesus. Yeah. I You know, I don't know. I don't know what about a child needs saving. But I guess that's kind of dogmatic, isn't it? But it's that term. Children's Crusade. Sherman, set the Wayback Machine for the 13th century. Yeah, a little more than 900 years ago. More particularly, set the Wayback Machine, Sherman, for 1212. In 1212, a little boy, either in France or Germany, began to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. In his message, he preached that he had been visited by Jesus, and that in his vision, he was told to lead a crusade to the Levant, that tormented place, which was already tormented by then by God, really, by God, or his representatives on earth, because by then the Christians had already invaded the Levant and slaughtered Muslim and Jew alike and set up the kingdom of Jerusalem. You know, it was a transplanted European style state for the age, which had been transplanted onto the Levant and was entirely and solely supported by outside forces, to wit, European kingdoms and principalities and duchies and earldoms and whatnot. Of course, it couldn't survive on its own. And the Kingdom of Jerusalem, also known as Outre-mer, raised 17 shades of unmitigated hell with the people who had already been living there for quite some time. So the Children's Crusade, although it is said to maybe be not quite this as true as it was handed down through history, a little boy said that Jesus visited him and told him to lead a crusade to peacefully convert Muslims to Christianity. According to the story, which may be a little bit like a fairy tale or a little bit like the Pied Piper of Hamelin. Oh, wait, that's a fairy tale. Thousands and thousands of children followed him. And lots of children were given passage. To the Holy Land, such as it's called. And then, I mean, there was Peter the Hermit and the children's, and it didn't work out well. Let's just say it did not work out well. It might have just been a mass migration. A lot of them gave up and went home eventually. And a lot of people died in the process. So, lo and behold, the highway to holiness. Oh, John Fox, if only you were listening, you'd already be working on the parody. I'm on the highway to holiness. So the Highway to Holiness Church, Highway of Holiness, I'm sorry, had their children's crusade, at which point it became apparent to a parent named Tanya Cotton that in the midst of the children's crusade to which she had sent her 10-year-old son, and which he had then recorded with his phone, because 10-year-olds have video phones now, and this is kind of a good thing here. Well, she recognized a guy named Dale Hoffert Jr. Remember, this is Moran Monday. Who's Dale Hoffert Jr.? Dale Hoffert Jr. was imprisoned on a charge in 2007 of forcible oral sodomy. You know, I really don't want any details beyond that, do you? Because either way, it's icky. Either way, it's a freaking crime. Either way, it's, well, it smacks of rape now, doesn't it? I'm recalling Kate's note of a few nights ago. How did Tanya Cotton manage to recognize Dale Hoffert Jr.? Well, Dale Hoffert Jr., up until being convicted of forcible oral sodomy in 2007, up until then, he was the youth pastor at Highway of Holiness Church. Tanya Cotton said, I was upset. I was sick to my stomach. You should send your kids to church and feel safe about it. Oh, Tanya, we need to talk. Pedophiles and child abusers and child rapists, well, they tend to congregate in churches because churches have a profoundly authoritarian structure in which one is not supposed to question authority. So it turns out that, yes, that was Dale Hoffert Jr., and, yes, he had been released from prison earlier this year on a suspended sentence from forcible oral sodomy. Oh, by the way, the news account does note, as though it makes much difference, the victim was not a member of the church. Well, good. As if somehow that should allay mother's fears there. So here then is the blow off. Folks went to the pastor of Highway of Holiness Church, who is John Steiger, and said, hey, did you have that Hoffert character here? You did know that he got busted for forcible oral sodomy, didn't you? And Steiger admitted that, yep, at the Children's Crusade, convicted forcible sodomizer, whatever that may mean, please, for the love of God, do not send me the Oklahoma Revised Statute on forcible oral sodomy. My third eye is already needing bleached. He confirmed that Hoffert was there at the Children's Crusade. I don't see anything in there, and the fact that he was the youth pastor there indicates that he was not a child, so why are you at the Children's Crusade? Oh, well. But then, by way of explanation, Highway of Holiness Church Pastor John Steiger said, well, he wasn't around, he wasn't alone with a child that day. Not he wasn't around children, he wasn't alone with a child. Well, I feel better already. Oof. And then by way of explaining why a convicted sex criminal was allowed at the Children's Crusade, Pastor Steiger said, they sentenced him. I wonder who they are. Obviously not Christians. They sentenced him
He paid his debt to society. We're a church that believes that God can change people. Never mind the scientific evidence that if you, this is one of those problems that if you've got it, you're probably never going to get rid of it. Oh, well. And so after explaining about how God can change people, Pastor Steiger continued, "A church is a hospital for the soul. We help lost souls. We've done what a church is supposed to do, help a lost soul change their way."
Yeah, okay. But do you have to do it by allowing him to be in a room full of children?
That seemed to be the nature of Tanya Cotton's contention. She said, "His past is not good with children. Do not be tempting him with our kids." I told you that Jessica sent this in about, an hour and 48 minutes ago. I'll be honest, when I first opened the email, I thought, no, this is an old story. Because I was suddenly reminded of that, I was thinking it was the story of the church there on the Tennessee-Stan-Kentucky Stan border that hired a convicted rapist to be its pastor. And that preacher said something along the lines of, "We investigated the charges and found them to be without merit." Mother. More in Monday. Oh, yeah. And let's take a trip down, since we're in Oklahoma staying already, let's take a trip down south of the Red River, which, I tell you, one of the most horrifying scenes of all of film, and I've seen my fair share of horror movies and stuff, but one of the most horrifying scenes in all of film, and it's pretty horror, it's maybe even more horrifying in the actual book, is from Lonesome Dove, when Captain Call and Gus McRae and all the cowboys are driving their cattle north to Montana, and they cross the Red River, which at that time is apparently just chock-a-block full of water moccasin cottonmouth snakes. And the water just slithers with snakiness. And one of the poor young cowboys winds up getting bit to death. See, the shivers have started. But anyway, let's venture south from Oklahoma Stan, over the Red River, and down into Texas Stan. Where a pair of parents went to court defending their religious liberty because they had pulled their children out of school to homeschool them. And then it turned out they weren't homeschooling anybody.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The McIntyre twins were going to be homeschooled, only the parents decided not so much. Evidence adduced at trial by Michael McIntyre's twin brother Tracy was to the effect that their parents
used an empty space in a motorcycle dealership that was co-owned by one of the parents as the classroom. Tracy McIntyre did, however, testify. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm probably screwing this up. But anyway, Tracy McIntyre said he never, ever saw the children reading books, using computers, or doing arithmetic. Instead, the children were seen playing instruments and singing. Jesus loves the little children. Right. It also came into court that one of the children had been overheard telling a cousin that because they were homeschooled, they didn't have to do homework. Because mommy and daddy said they was about to get raptured. Mm-hmm. Raptured. Michael and Laura McIntyre are the parents. Tracy is Michael's twin brother. And this is somewhere down near the West Texas town of El Paso. And this case goes all the way back to 2006, kind of the way that the Oklahoma Stand case goes all the way back to a case of forcible oral sodomy in 2007. In 2006, the El Paso Independent School District called the parents in for a meeting because they had received an anonymous complaint that the children were not being edumacated. This just gets weirder and weirder. One of the McIntyre children, a young girl, had actually run away from school in order to be able to, had run away from home in order to be able to attend school. Isn't this the kind of story we're used to hearing coming out of Pakistan and Afghanistan? And yes, 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 it is. So how's about the next time that some right-winger starts talking about those heathens over there? Shut up! Shut up! We got that problem over here. You got little girls running away from home just to go to school because they confirmed that she was enrolled at Coronado High School. So, truancy complaints were filed against the McIntyres in 2007, and then the McIntyres, in turn, probably with some free religion industry lawyer, filed a suit for injunctive relief under the Texas Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Where have we heard that before? Yeah, the U.S. Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That's the grounds and basis of the Hobby Lobby decision. And you'll note that in Hobby Lobby, that statute was used to flog away at women who wanted to have full coverage for contraception. And the Supreme Court said, Well, this case was heard by the Texas 8th District Court of Appeals, state court. And the Texas 8th District Court of Appeals, as opposed to the Supreme Court of the United States, said, hold on! Stop! Wait, what? Because the appeals court said, no. Making children go to school does not violate a parent's First Amendment rights. Here's the language from the case. No parents have ever prevailed in any reported case on a theory that they have an absolute constitutional right to educate their children in the home completely free of any state supervision, regulation, or requirements. They do not have an absolute constitutional right to homeschool. Marty asking, doomsday preppers? Oh, Hobby Lobby shoppers! Doomsday preppers. Macrameing for the end times. Hallelujah. What's interesting, though, is that a case can conceivably go through state court, up to the state Supreme Court, and arguably to the United States Supreme Court from the state Supreme Court. Y'all keep an eye out, and I will too, because if these rapture-ready idiots have one of those free religion industry lawyers, what do you want to bet this thing goes up to the rats? Wouldn't that be a lovely decision to read? Wouldn't you just love it? Can't you see the opinion crafted by Fat Tony Scalia now? Constitutional originalism requires that I hold that DC parents don't have to send their children to school while they's waiting on the rapture. Because after all, in the time of the framers of the Constitution, there wasn't much in the way of a public school system. If you learned anything, you learned it by going to your church and kind of school. You know, like I went to. Like my daddy, the chief American fascist member of the Mussolini fan club, done sended me to. You know, like that. Clearly, freedom and liberty require that if the McIntyre children have to wait for the rapture and never get taught nothing as a result, even if the rapture don't come, constitutional originalism says that it don't matter. And freedom. Wolverines! My head's beginning to spin just with this, the very beginning of Moran Monday. So let's remember, Paul from Parts Unknown's $50 challenge is on the table. ASA has gotten us started. Our ordinary fundraising goal of the evening is $150. That takes us down to $130. And so, you know, up to $50, whatever you kick in the next couple of hours, gets doubled. 5 will get you 10, 10 will get you 20, 20 will get you a river of beer flowing over your grandmother's paisley shawl. Yeah. So, break time. And, of course, the lines are open for this year, Moran Monday. You are more than welcome and, in fact, encouraged to contribute your own tales of right-wing Moranity. The number, 304-574-8178, 304-574-8178, or just Skype to Skype on here. Bob Kincaid Horn is the contact address. BobKincaidHorn. Bob Kincaid Horn. So we will, in fact, take a break and see what's happening on the other side. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Six and a half minutes past the hour.
this 11th day of August 2014. I am, in fact, Bob Kincaid. This is the Horn, More and Monday. And this is not a More and Monday nomination by any stretch of the imagination, no. But I got a note from our buddy the Angry Indian via Skype right during the break. Robin Williams is dead. Yeah. Outlets from Variety to Huffington Post, TMZ, all reporting, and many different media outlets in between, reporting that he was found, Robin Williams, comedian, Academy Award-winning actor. His unresponsive body was found inside his home in Tiburon, California, in Marin County. I hate how these stories get written. Now, of course, this will be followed up by a lengthy obituary. I'm looking at the TMZ copy, and I'm not sure. Variety wouldn't load, and Huffington Post wouldn't load. Oddly enough, TMZ must have enough server capacity to be able to handle the load, so that's what I got. Robin Williams has committed suicide. The comedian killed himself in Tiburon, Northern California. According to Marin County Sheriff's Office, authorities found Williams' body inside his home. And no, TMZ, you ungrammatical idiots. W-I-L-L-I-A-M apostrophe S is not how you refer to that. Copy editing is dead. It would be W-I-L-L-I-A-M-S apostrophe, because he was Robin Williams, not Robin William. Jesus. He was unconscious and not breathing, and the coroner suspects suicide due to asphyxia. Last seen alive at his house at 10 p.m. last night. And why I hate these stories? This. Williams went back to rehab last month to focus on his sobriety. We're told alcohol was an issue. Williams struggled with cocaine and alcohol abuse in the early 80s, but was sober for 20 years. Williams was 63. For those of you of a certain age, you might remember the CNN Hollywood gossip reporter Sandy Kenyon. His tag out was Sandy Kenyon, CNN. Hollywood. And it always ended. Robin Williams was 63. Sandy Kenyon, CNN, Hollywood. I'm sad. I'm saddened by this. Never knew the man. Never met the man. But God did not get, well, I think it was Mark, was it Aristotle or Mark Twain? You know, those two can be mentioned in the same sentence. Was it Aristotle or Mark Twain who opined that the source of all comedy lay in sadness? Thank you, Angry, the Angry Indian pointing out. Yeah. What jerks. No effing copy editor. He's got kids, former spouses. I hope they'll be okay. That's all you can really say. And I'm going to refrain from saying anything else. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hey, Edward.
Well, I was so sorry to hear about Robin Williams.
Me too. Me too.
I really liked him. He was a very funny person. But evidently had lots of problems. You know, people in those positions, some of them, have very bad problems.
You know what? To be as funny as he was, it would be almost inconceivable if he didn't.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. Yeah. It's very difficult to be funny all the time. But anyway, since this is Boyland Monday, I have a little more vanity for you.
Oh, do.
Well, I was watching last night the David Pakman show on Free Speech TV, and he got on a thing about old Toadface Hagee.
Oh, dear God.
And you know, those who won't work, won't eat, and all that sort of stuff. And a little light came on in my feeble brain back somewhere, and I thought, And of course, he was quoting Paul in Thessalonians. Did I say that correctly?
As correctly as any one of us can hope to. Yes.
Well, I have trouble with those biblical terms. I'm sort of like Minnie Pearl, who said, "I got my tongue in front of my eye tubes, and I couldn't see what I was saying."
Well, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
We love Minnie Pearl. Anyway, lo and behold. I'll read a little thing here for you. According to Lenin, quote, "He who does not work shall not eat," end quote, is a necessary principle under socialism, the primary phase of the evolution towards communist society. The phrase appears in his 1917 work, The State and Revolution. Through this slogan, Lenin explains that in socialist states, only productive individuals could be allowed access to the articles of consumption.
Well,
We're in the reading.
So isn't that interesting, Edward? Because I think the same evening that we were talking about that, we were also talking about, who was it, Brian Fisher of the American Family Association?
Mm-hmm.
Who, and this has gotten a lot of traction in the last few days since I brought it to people's attention as well. Not that I drove that or anything, but you know what I mean. So that guy was siding with the radical fundamentalist bloodthirsty ISIS fighters who like to kill Yazidi people because they think they worship devils. And lo and behold, here comes Pastor John Hagee talking Leninism from the pulpit. I wonder if anybody's pointed this out to that nasty old fraud.
Well, I don't know whether they have or not, but it's right here in black and white. Because I had my partner print it off for me. Oh, and there is also a lovely poster, all in red, has these two little wire rings. And hanging from them is a hammer and a spoon. And the quote is, in Russian, which I cannot read, "He who does not work shall not eat." That was a 1920s communist poster. I bet old Hagee doesn't know that he's a communist. Isn't that amazing?
I wonder how his congregation would feel about that down in San Antonio.
They love that. Why, he's been talked bad about and reviled, and they would just come to his aid. Oh, please. There'd be more chicken and mashed potatoes and gravy than you've ever seen. And blueberry pie.
Not blueberry pie, Edward, please. Let us have some modicum of decency on this program.
I'm sorry. My aunt used to make the best blueberry pies. We used to go out and pick the blueberries. Oh, one time, the wild ones are better than the commercial ones. The wild ones are sweeter. And I got home, and I was just itching like crazy. And I had an absolute horrible case of we call them red bugs down there, but as chiggers, they're known usually as.
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord, I had to go to the doctor and get something to put on them. But the pie was good anyway. Oh, me. Well, I'll let
you know,
I was going to say,
you remind me, I saw a photograph from my friends up in northern Michigan and northern Wisconsin the other day. This huge bowl of wild-picked blueberries.
Woo!
Oh, there's nothing like the wild ones. They're smaller. But the flavor is just, indescribable.
If you haven't had them, you just don't know what we're talking about. But I do, and you do, too.
Elderberries aren't shabby, either.
No. And actually, this lady I knew up in Kansas, an elderly lady, she could make the best gooseberry pie. And ordinarily, I don't like gooseberries, but she could make a really delicious gooseberry pie.
I go off into rapturous bliss over gooseberries. When I was a little boy, and on this on this very property, my grandmother had a series of gooseberry bushes.
Oh, yes.
And if we came to visit at just the right time of year, which would be about now, my cousins and I would fight like little demons with each other to get at those gooseberries. And so when we first took up residence here, one of the first things I looked into was, well, the gooseberry bushes are gone. So I need to replace the gooseberries. And guess what? You can't.
What?
You cannot plant gooseberries here anymore.
Oh.
Or you can't.
But
what it turns out is I would have to, it's not a climate change thing, I don't think. No, apparently there is some sort of fungus that occurs naturally on the outer skins of the gooseberries, and if birds eat them, and then, you know, birds will where they roost, right?
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of white pine around here, and they tend to roost in those white pine trees, and the fungus causes something called white pine blister rot, which can take down a white pine forest in lickety-split.
You're telling me that happened in North Carolina, too. The pine trees. Oh,
so,
well.
So no gooseberries for me.
Well, I haven't had any in a long time, but this lady, her name was Mae Zettmeyer. She was German, and she came to Kansas in a covered wagon, and she was the grandmother of a dear friend of mine, and boy, could she make good gooseberry pies. I mean, it just made me want to scream and shout.
I can well imagine.
Well, you take care. I just wanted to let you know about old Toad Face Haggy, that he really doesn't know it, but he's a communist.
And a Leninist.
Yes,
he's a Leninist. Oh, and by the way, note coming in from Jim before you go there, Edward. Jim asking, ever had gooseberry wine? Look out.
No, I haven't, but the wine we had there in eastern North Carolina was made from a wild grape called the scuppernong grapes.
Oh, muscadines and scuppernongs.
My neighbor right across the street, Margaret, her uncle was the best winemaker in Carter County, and he was also a Primitive Baptist preacher. But he belonged to a sect of the Primitive Baptists that didn't think it was a sin to drink or dance as long as you did it in moderation. Anyway, the phone would ring around Christmas time, and it would be Margaret on the phone, and she'd say, Edward Earl, I just got my Christmas gift from Uncle Walter. You want to come over and try it? And I'd say, yeah. Over
right
I'd go. We'd sit around the dining table drinking that scuppernong wine and smoking cigarettes. And I finally said, Margaret, I got to go home. Wow, I could hardly make it back across the street.
God's own drunk
appearance
kind of man. Yep.
Take care.
All right. You have a good evening, Edward, and Well, now you got me. Now you got me thinking about homemade wine.
Ooh-wee, it's come out kind of good.
Yes, it
is. Oh, haven't had any Mr. Walter's wine in a long time because he's been gone for a long time. You take care, and all of the other hornies take care, too.
Will do. You take care as well, Edward. Have a good evening. Bye.
Thank you, and you do, too. Bye-bye.
Love my conversations with Edward. Something mighty special. Let's keep things rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey there, how you doing?
Hey, Jim, what's happening? Gooseberry wine, huh?
Oh, my Lord. That will definitely send you right around where you don't want to be or do want to be.
Cure what ails you.
And as well for the scuppernongs. My father's oldest brother had a huge, huge vineyard and used to make a lot of that scuppernong wine. And I think I was like 15, and I always used to enjoy seeing my uncle because he was just, he was kind of a, well, he never followed a whole lot. He sort of sought his own path. He was an excellent pianist, and he was postmaster there in Camden, South Carolina, a long time. He was a Marine, went down to Haiti, and some of the stories he used to tell me about Haiti and voodoo were just incredible. But anyway, I got up there just to listen to Uncle Grover, and he was talking about Haiti and some of the stuff there. And he offered me a glass of that scuppernong wine, a big glass, like 8 ounces. And other than community wine, I never had anything else as far as being alcoholic is concerned. I made it for it since. But nonetheless.
Sorry, that's just the...
That's all right.
No, that was right. No, that was just perfectly... I'm sorry, that was just perfectly timed.
Good, good. Never want to interfere with timing. But nonetheless, when I finally got home, my dad noticed that my demeanor was a little changed, and he said, "What have you been doing?" And I said, "Well, Uncle Grover gave me a glass of his homemade scuppernong wine." And my dad said, "Lord, he made a call to him and just said, look here, I'd appreciate it because the boy's driving and you live pretty far out in the country." He lived about 50 miles out in the country and had his own bomb shelter. This is back when everybody was building a bomb shelter. And he had that thing built exactly proper, and you know, as far as the directions, the turn from radiation around corners and things. And Bob, when I went in there and saw his main chamber, I don't think any liquor store in Camden had as much booze in there as he did.
He was ready for the apocalypse.
He was ready for the apocalypse. He certainly was, absolutely. And I have fond memories of him and his wife, my Aunt Dot, and we used to talk a lot until the past couple of years when she passed away. And he was a very interesting member of my family. And told me a lot of stories about Haiti. I mean,
well, you mentioned the Marines in Haiti. I wonder if he served under Smedley Butler. Was he old enough to have done that?
Probably. He was born in, late 19th, early, I think early 20th century.
Yeah, that about put him there.
But he was there in Port-au-Prince, the Iron Gate, and remembered a lot of stuff about, the practice of voodoo or Santeria, I think it's called. And it was very powerful, even back then. But he had a lot of stories to share, and I was glad I was around to listen to him. I just wish I'd had a tape recorder.
Yeah.
I'm very sorry to hear about Robbie Williams. That's very sad. He was quite good at Mrs. Doubtfire, but I think one of the former films that he did, To Wong Fu with Love, Julie Newmar, when he played John Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt, and he was in that too.
I didn't remember him in that film, of course. I always think
Yeah, he was there with Wesley Snipes and Patrick Swayze when they just won that drag competition.
He wasn't one of the principals then.
No, he wasn't. You remember that's when they had the big drag ball and RuPaul descends and a Confederate flag great thing. It's racial tension.
Yeah.
Talk about something that would open your
eyes. I'd forgotten that name, but not now.
It's racial tension. Anyway, so that's very sad that he has left us. What can one say? Sic transit gloria mundi. And as you said before, sometimes the people who try to be the funniest are in fact, indeed, internally, not so funny, not so happy.
Indeed, indeed.
But anyway, I don't know what you're doing. Wish you luck with your procedures on whenever.
Oh, it's called an EGD. I mean, they stick a hose down your throat and look around.
Yeah, you know, well, they do that a lot. Bronchoscopes, stuff like that, you know.
Yeah, this is gullet, not breathing.
Right, right. I mean, they do all kinds of stuff to this.
But I can guarantee you this. When I come up out of the anesthesia, because this is consistent, the first thing I will want, chips and salsa. I don't know why, but every time I've ever had either this or the steel eel on the other end, I wake up and I want chips and salsa. Go figure.
Well, I'm sure it'll be available for you once you get out of that procedure. I'm baking quiche right now.
Absolutely. Oh, yummy. What kind?
Oh, it's a real simple recipe, and I found it on a jar of Grey Poupon mustard, but it's that Jimmy Dean sausage with sage. You get that all cooked up and everything and drain it, and then, of course, all you do, you, of course, have to preheat your pie shells. And once those pie shells are ready to receive, you just mix the sausage with half and half, Swiss cheese, and diced spring onions.
No egg?
And a great big dollop of any spice and mustard that you can find. I use the Grey Poupon because that's where I got the recipe from.
I love the flavor of that particular mustard. Although I've mentioned before, I often find it at Big Lots now, 12-ounce jars, because I've got one right here handy. I try to keep some handy.
Grey Poupon?
No. 12-ounce bottles of original stadium mustard from Cleveland.
Stadium mustard.
Nothing like it. It's similar to Grey Poupon, but it's got a little bit more kick.
Stadium.
Yeah, just original stadium mustard from Cleveland.
Okay. Well,
they often have, and when I, because, you know, they never have the same thing twice at Big Lots. Because they're just buying closeouts and overruns and stuff. But when I see it, I usually buy three or four bottles.
You know, I don't understand the grocery stores these days because they're always resetting this and resetting that. And they're always taking, you know, things off the shelves that you used to buy. And I don't know who makes that decision. But, you know, Kroger, for example, somebody needs to have their ass kicked.
They all do it, though. I'm trying to remember where I was the other day. I walked into a store, and it was completely reversed from the last time I'd been in there. I just wandered around lost for a while. And I personally think it's marketing. Because
crazy.
No, but if you're used to everything being where everything is supposed to be, then you get in and you get out. If they can get you to wander a little bit more, they'll make a little more money off of it.
You think that's the reason why?
It makes sense to me.
Just to perplex people. And, hell, it just makes things that much more uncomfortable, really. And it just puts people in a worse mood. And the people who are in a worse mood are...
Well, when's the last time you saw somebody smiling in Walmart?
Bob, I haven't been to Walmart I went one time, and that was over 16 years ago, and I've never been back.
Good for you.
I don't like that store. I don't like the people. I don't like the way they treat their employees. I don't like the fact that the Walton family probably has more money than than God.
Well, more money than several small countries, I have no doubt.
Well, yeah, and they also have some type of talk about these people who are doomsday preppers.
Mm-hmm.
I understand they have a complex that's larger than that of the president.
Wow.
I don't know if that's true or not. I just
you mean the Walton heirs do?
Yeah, the Walton heirs.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, no. I wouldn't be surprised if they've got a bunker because, you know, they've got a lot of money. They deserve to survive the coming apocalypse.
Well, whatever. They're prepared for it because I understand that bunker is probably as big as anything that the government could construct, whether it would be at the Greenbrier, the former place where they would go, or wherever, or Mount Weather, or whatever. But I understand that, you know, they have just built this huge complex. And I just wonder, what do they plan to come out to?
That's a good question. But I think they're going to come out to a world in which they will offer some sort of bare minimum existence to the people crawling around outside. In other words, Walmart. It's just going to be, the whole world's going to be Walmart then. We cannot have a mineshaft gap, Jim.
Well, I don't know if plans go according to schedule, I'm afraid there won't be a whole lot left for them to market. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's just strange.
It's going to be a big market in dry beans and rice and, you know, freeze-dried foie gras and, oh, God. I mean, somebody's going to have to sell stuff to the other rich people getting out of their bunkers, Jim.
Well, the trouble is, they're not going to have anybody left to say anything to. That's the thing.
But that's the thing. That is the thing. They don't believe that, Jim. They believe that their wealth will ultimately save them because in the current climate, in the last generation or so, that has certainly been the case. It has saved them from having to pay taxes. It saved them from having to participate in civic society. It has saved them from having to deal with a government actually concerned with the well-being of all its citizens instead of just the Walmart heirs. I mean, based on the empirical data, as the Walmart heirs can see them, it's been pretty effective. But they haven't tested it against radiation, fallout, or, I don't know, Ebola.
Exactly. And in so doing, they will have hoisted themselves on their own petard. I really think so.
I'd buy a ticket to that hoisting.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see.
Maybe they could get a free tumbril ride to it.
Well, maybe.
And I know you know what I mean.
Yeah, I don't think there'll be any conciergerie for them to sit around and wait for the guy to knock on that door to take them down to the Place de la Concorde. Speaking of which, another thing, this business in the Middle East, this is just incredible. And I don't know what they're going to do about it.
Well, I'm almost rendered speechless.
The only thing I can see, and maybe I'm wrong here, will be, efforts of nations acting in concert. And also,
to what end? To what end? I mean, I'm not arguing with you, but that's the thing. We can act in concert. We could, you know, maybe.
They're going to have to go in there and take care of these people, these ISI people. That's all there is to it.
But did you notice that Maliki in Baghdad is losing his marbles?
Well, he's holding on, but he's not going to last that much longer.
Well, I think he's feeling that DM wind blowing across him, don't you?
Well, I know so. I mean, after what John Kerry said to him today, I mean, he just told him, look, you better get your ass out of there. But he's got some soldiers in this capital, And, of course, how long is that going to last? Not too much longer. I would hope, and I'm just thinking off the cuff here, we definitely need to change our position with Iran. And also, we need to talk to Mr. Putin about some things, too.
Oh, speaking of Mr. Putin, you will get... you'll get a big kick out of this. You know how I talk, Jim, about all the right-wing weird-ass emails I get every day?
You? You see the ones I get.
I get enough, thanks. I'm not up for sharing.
Nor I either.
You're gonna so laugh at this. I got one today, and this is just, so there's this right-wing preacher, and, you know, the right wing has developed a real fondness for Vladimir Putin, especially because, you know, he's not nearly as dark as that Barack Obama. So I think it's in Harlem, this church, the Blood of Jesus Outlaw World Missionary Church, James David Manning Pastor.
I see.
And he has been on a tear for several years now. I mean, he hates him some Barack Obama, that's all. So... recently.
In Harlem?
Yeah.
Okay. And this guy is, I guess, black?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so he's taken to prophesying. And he recently prophesied, "I want to prognosticate today that 100 days from this very hour, either Vladimir Putin himself or one of his assistants or someone within the Russian government we'll call Mr. Long-Legged Mac Daddy, we'll call him an outright gay pervert homosexual sodomite. This will happen within 100 days. We're starting the countdown today. Tomorrow, obviously, will be 99 days before it will actually take place."
Now, just a second. He's saying that Putin will come out as being gay?
No. Putin will out Obama as gay.
Oh, out Obama as gay. Okay, all right. Oh, wow. I'm sure TMZ will have fun with that. Where do they find these people?
On his website, he put up a photograph, one of those side-by-side comparisons. One of them shows Vladimir Putin petting a leopard cub. Next to it is a picture of Barack Obama holding a poodle.
Oh, dear.
That's his evidence.
I just don't know. I mean, you know, just when one thinks that the screen has reached the height of its fulfillment, new wonders appear. That's for damn sure.
This character has also said that Barack Obama, the son of Satan, sends white homo demons to scoop up black guys and take them away from black women.
Well, I mean, you know... I understand, and I can't speak with too much authority, but I'm not going to, you know, attribute this to any type of race, creed, or color, but from my experience, there are plenty of down-low people out there, Bob. They don't need me.
Right, regardless of race, creed, or color.
Exactly. I mean, I can remember when, oh, God. Well, he's there. He can't possibly be gay. And I thought to myself, God in heaven, I'd rather have a married man because at least he goes home.
You did it again.
I'm sorry. You just brought... You
wicked,
you
wicked, wicked man.
You bring it out. And I have to expiate it through this phone call. Lord,
well, it's kind of like an exorcism then, isn't it?
I guess.
Come out!
Yeah. out that spot. Out that spot. Oh, God.
You gotta wonder if that's what Vladimir Putin says to his pet leopard when he's sending him out in the morning. Out, damn spot!
Well, I mean, if he has a pet leopard, as long as he treats it right, that's fine. I mean, Gary used to have pet cubs brought to him from the Berlin Zoo. He had one named Caesar. There's a picture of him on every night on the History Channel with everything that they talk about Gerink or Gerink, which he hated because Gerink meant, like, you know, an asshole. Nonetheless, there would be a picture of old Herman sitting there petting Caesar, his pet lion cub or whatever. But, you know, going back to this thing, I don't know what we're going to do as far as to stabilize the situation in the Middle East, but I'll say this, and I'm going to let you go here because you got other people want to talk. We sure as hell made a hell of a fucking mistake when we went in there and broke up that thing in the first place.
Didn't we? And it becomes a worse mistake, Jim, when you consider who was counseling against it. It's not like the only people in the United States were saying, George, don't do this. It's not like his shrink was the only one saying it. It wasn't just, you know, the liberals, the progressives, the peaceniks. It was Brent Scowcroft. It was his daddy. And frankly, if his daddy had never said it, he might never have done it. Hey, daddy, I'm going to show you I'm a bigger man than you. And
well,
so
his father had sense enough to stop, you know, and not go in and, because he realized what a destabilization that would occur in that country. At least I'll give
which
that
is exactly
to,
what happened.
And, of course, you know, W, being led by whomever or whatever, decided that he was going to go in there to make a name for himself, bigger than his daddy, and, of course, dragged so many people into that thing who have come back from it in such horrible conditions. You realize there are 58,000 veterans today that are homeless?
Yeah. And those numbers are only going to get worse, not better.
Exactly. I mean, these guys went over there, I guess, you know. I mean, they volunteered to go, and they went in good spirit. Being led by the chain of command, I can understand that. I've had a lot of experience in the area. But they were misled. And the shock and awe, what did it produce? It produced shock and awe, all right, and we're seeing the fallout of it.
And we are awestruck by the shock of it. Yeah, we're the ones who... And that's not to discount the horror that was dropped on Baghdad that night, but it has boomeranged back upon us, Jim. And the question, and of course I'm no great strategic mind, but the question that arises is, if you are willing to go in and destabilize an entire region, you have then got to do something to stabilize it, or else it's just going to remain a perpetual problem. And in the ancient world, the way you stabilized was you took group A and you either killed them all or you drove them away to somewhere else. Agreed? And then you repopulated with people of your preferred choosing.
Or you could assimilate, if possible.
Not a lot of assimilating. I mean, technically speaking, in the ancient world.
Well,
and
I
see,
mean,
we don't have a taste for that anymore. We recognize
I mean, China
it as
was a, China was a great nation to assimilate its conquerors, you know?
Well,
that's
yeah.
The only reason I mentioned that word.
Oh, yeah, they assimilated the conquerors, but the very few assimilated to the conquest itself.
Yeah, I guess so. But
and so we're faced with something. I mean, and a lot of this has to do with map drawing, too. And it's map drawing that took place in 1919.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
So, the Germans and the Ottomans are on the out. They've lost the First World War. So the winning powers, namely France and England and the United States and Italy got kind of left out in the cold on that, too. But
for which they tried to make up, you know.
Well, you know, we let Italy have interests in Libya and said, you know, go and be happy. But the French and the English carved up the Middle East. That's how Lebanon and Syria wind up with a French influence, and that's how Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Transjordan and what was then simply referred to as Palestine wind up with a British influence, and the British influence in Persia as well, because they were carving up the old Ottoman Empire. Well, none of those lines actually made any sense, did they, Jim?
No, I remember there was one female cartographer who acted in concert with other members of governments to make these lines that made no sense.
And they didn't take into account tribal rivalries or ethnic or religious rivalries? Nothing.
Well, you know, like T.D. Lawrence said, you know, they were just a little people without any consequence.
Well, they were certainly treated that way.
And they were, considering the fact that these people in the Middle East, centuries before, were living in a much higher standard of living as far as their cities, urban planning.
Yeah.
Exploits into the sciences, algebra, even our own alphabet, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these people were highly intelligent and extremely gifted. But apparently, these conquering nations, being ever cognizant of their so-called white man's burden.
Thank you, Mr. Kipling.
Didn't see it that way. And I'll leave on this note. I will never forget that movie, Lawrence of Arabia, What Fog Rains, when he was playing the part of that British diplomat, said, there are two kinds of lies. The first lie is a man who hides the truth completely. And the second type of lie is a gentleman who's completely forgotten where he placed it.
Exactly, exactly.
Enjoy talking to you, Bob.
You have a good evening, Jim. Take care.
Do the best. Smell in the oven. Bye.
All right, bye now. Yeah, I mean, and I suspect that no one really wants to confront this, but how do you create a viable polity out of a group of people who are majority Shia, minority Sunni, with Kurds, and a little pocket of some of the oldest Christian sects on the planet, and the Yazidis? How do you do that? Or I think better put, how do you impose that? Now, see, the ISIS, ISIL, whatever you want to call them, they're working on that ancient model I was talking with Jim about. They're going to come in and slaughter and kill until they get things balanced out to where they want it to be. Call it ethnic cleansing, call it genocide, call it what you will. They're not necessarily moving according to religion. They are moving according to their policy goals, and they are using religion as the barrel staves upon which they are skiing across the sands. Religion comes in awful handy in a lot of different ways. Ancient history is replete with stories of human migrations that are stopped, people that are displaced, sold into slavery, entire area. There are more. Look at the eradication of Carthage. There were three Punic Wars. And in the third Punic War, that's the one that most resembles our assault on Iraq in 2003. At the end of the second Punic War, horrible punitive terms had been imposed upon Carthage. Then, at the instigation of a man named Cato the Elder, whose great-grandson would prove to be as bad or worse, Cato the Elder used to wander around 2nd century BCE Rome, mumbling, Cartago delenda est, Cartago delenda est. I mean, he would have fit right in with the second Bush administration. Cartago delenda est means Carthage must be destroyed. Until enough people began to listen to him that Rome decided to gin up some pretenses of war against Carthage, and they went in and they utterly destroyed Carthage. The ruins are there to this day. The historical accounts from back then say that they salted the earth and killed every living thing, so that never again might Carthage rise. For those with a taste for history, well, there was also the accounts that the Carthaginians sacrificed little babies to their heathen gods. You remember the incubator story from Kuwait in the first Bush War? The one that was completely false? Yeah, that. There is nothing new under the sun. Look at the Bible itself. Look at Deuteronomy. Look at how God tells the children of Israel to go in and commit genocide after genocide after genocide so as to be able to occupy the land of milk and honey. That's actually the model that most of the world has used. You want the land, you kill everybody on it. It's that easy. It's that simple. I'm not saying it is right, righteous, decent, or moral, but that's how most of human history, since the rise of agriculture and kingdom, city, states, polities, have handled it. You go in, you conquer the place, you kill all the males and you sell the women and children off into slavery, but you keep some for yourself. There's one of those accounts right there in the Old Testament too. I think in one case 32 virgins were reserved to be sacrificed unto the Lord God. That's the trouble with reading that. And so we're going to be long-term bombing. We may, not will. We may be long-term bombing the ISIS forces. And we're probably going to engage in that abject act of silliness known as training the Iraqis to stand up for themselves. What was it Dim Leader said? When the Iraqis stand up, we'll stand down. God Almighty. 5 minutes before the hour on this More In Monday. And a reminder that Paul from Parts Unknown's challenge remains on the table. Thank you to Kate for being the first to reference it and respond to it. Kate said, how about everybody in the chat room throwing in $5 or $10? Lovely idea, Kate. Thank you. So Kate doubled her 20 to 40. Sal doubled his 5 to 10. So that means that there is another $25 to go to meet Paul from Parts Unknown's challenge, his own birthday challenge. It's rather a hobbit approach, if you think about it. So thanks to everybody who has jumped in, and thank you to Asa for getting in early. Let's see. Thank you very much to Thomas. Thomas turned his 5 to 10, so that means there's $20 remaining in Paul from Parts Unknown's challenge. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com, or you can use the traditional mail address, which is at the bottom of the contribute page, if you are so inclined. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Man, you guys are on tonight, you and Jim.
Well, Jim and I have a long, long history, and we can pretty much wander the world at will, I think. What's happening, Bill?
Well, you know, the era you're talking about, right after World War One, right at the end of it, when the Ottomans fell apart, that's when the map opened up, and, you know, and all the greedy sons of bitches got their hands in there. And they had, you know, the British had to have oil because, you know, we sent them, like, I think I've told you this too many times, we sent about 5 American battleships over to Scapa Flow to operate with the British, and our ships were running diesel, were running oil. And the Brits and the Germans had been spent 4 years chasing around the world to get coal. There were actually laws about that. You could go into a neutral port with a German ship or a British ship, and German citizens would come out and help load the damn coal by hand, Bob. You know, they were just ordinary citizens. No one. But that is one of the turning points of world history as far as what has developed from it is that settlement after World War One. That crazy settlement, you know? Go in there. And personally, I've had one contact with, like, Iran after the seizing of the hostages. One of my friend's brothers was a hostage in Iran. He was part of the diplomatic service. I don't know how you feel, Bob, but a lot of diplomatic service is exactly that. Not every guy a woman who works in the embassies over there is a spy. What's your opinion?
I have a very low opinion of the United States' ability to conduct diplomacy.
Yep.
We've spent most of our brief history as a nation being really, really behind the learning curve, behind the French, behind the British, behind just about everybody. And we remain there. No, everybody's not a spy. Everybody is not a CIA station chief. But unfortunately, we conduct enough of our foreign relations that way that is the perception. And it's a self-made hell, Bill.
It's a thing to think about. I mean, how can we, can you tolerate this crew of Sunnis and what the stuff they ostensibly pull? Now, how much of that is true, we don't know. What's your opinion on that?
I think that they use, you talking about ISIS, ISIL, whatever they're being called, they use horror.
What's the spelling on that, Buck?
They use...
Make sure you say I. Go ahead.
They use horror to their advantage, as most militaries do. I did read a rather incisive piece over at TPM over the weekend from a person who allegedly has spent a great deal of time in that operational theater, saying that the few times that bunch tried to, under the guise of being Al-Qaeda in Iraq, he says they're basically the same bunch, who were not Al-Qaeda in the first place, let's be clear about that, that when they came up against organized professional military, they tended to melt. But against semi-competent or to incompetent military, like the Iraqi military or the Kurds, they're wildly successful because of the terror tactics that they use, the horror tactics. I think it was the Germans, and maybe I've got the word right. I hope I'm at least close. There was a German word for using horror in warfare that was, I believe, called Schrecklichkeit, or Schrecklichkeit, which basically boils down.
The Germans were pretty scary, Bob, in 1870s. They were scary bunch.
Well, war is not something conducted among gentlemen.
No, we like
to create that. I mean, and that's why we give the military the flashy uniforms and the spiffy, spit polished this and the shined up that and the squared away what's its is. We do all that so that when we see them who are not out there doing the dirty business that they do, and I'm not saying dishonorable, I'm saying war business.
It's dirty business, war, yes.
We don't see them like that. So we like to see them all prettied up and sparkly and flashy in their parades and carrying their flags, and because that's the image that we civilians like to have in our mind. But that is not the image of the battlefield. You know, as Jim referenced Rudyard Kipling a little bit ago, in Gunga Din, the old sergeant who's narrating it says, when it comes to slaughter, you'll do your work on water, and you'll lick the bloomin' boots of him that's got it.
Well,
that's what it is.
They were pretty miserable in India, for sure. And what was the King of the Khyber Rifles? You remember that movie about the era?
No, but I just got done watching The Man Who Would Be King, so.
Ah, you're close. The British operating on the borders of Afghanistan by the 1800s. They were active over there. That's one thing our British forebears, Bob, they were pretty aggressive too, you know. They did their part. The Navy was of course, the Navy in our lifetime has been replaced by the nuclear bombs. And that's what Sparky straightened me out on something I had heard during the 1975 war.
Oh, you mean when he went on alert in Thailand? And
well, our planes were on the alert.
Yeah.
After the 1974 war, when somehow the Egyptians got across the canal, but an Israeli counterattack pocketed maybe 150,000 Egyptians. And at that time, the Russians really took offense. And Nixon sent SAC in the air. I heard it on the early news and never heard it again. But when you hear about SAC being in the air, think about nuclear weapons and snap your fingers a couple of times and start counting. And start counting the population loss. After World War II, this country became a totally different place. They were bad enough, maybe, but they were compared with Europe, you know the size of our army in 1938?
It measured in the few tens of thousands.
About 17th in the world. The Bulgarians had more men under arms than we did, but of course we had the two ocean navy, and those two oceans protected this country in those days, like a magnetic field, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know, what's the bomber supposed to do? Or what's anybody supposed to do when you've got people running loose? I mean, do you think it's a bunch of propaganda about these invaders of Iraq? Or do you think it's Sunni Sufi? Once again, the good old nationality or the religious difference situation.
Well, not just that, but again, Bill, we come up against the drawing of really stupid, arbitrary lines. All you have to do is take a look at the ancient, and I'm sorry, I don't live in the ancient world, but I find myself visiting there quite often.
Well, you have a real strong knowledge of that.
The ancient Persian Empire was headed by a group of people who, their kings came from a group called the Achaemenids. And they had consolidated power, and the first thing they did was I think they came out of Medea, and then they conquered Persia, and then reached out and conquered Babylon, and most of what we recognize as Mesopotamia and the Middle East, all the way to Egypt and all the way to the Mediterranean Sea, including the requirement of a gift of water and earth. No, earth and fire. Earth and fire. The Greek city-states of the Asian mainland, you know, whether it be Turkey, Anatolia, the Levant, all the, well, they were the Persian, the emissaries of the Persian king showed up and said, look, you just need to acknowledge the great king's overlordship, give us an offering of fire and earth, and we'll just leave you to run things. And so most people don't understand, but the ancient Greek city-states were actually the terrorist states of the ancient world. The Persian Empire was a stable thing, at peace with itself for the most part. And it was from the Attic Peninsula that trouble came. But if you look at the old maps of the Persian Empire, and then post-Alexander, the rise of the Parthians, it's the same thing. Yeah. It's Mesopotamia over into Persia, and it's pretty unitary. But in 1919, there was no way that either France or England was going to let one or the other have all of that. So out of their own geopolitical needs, they carved it up without any regard whatsoever to the people who actually lived there. So you get a kingdom called Iraq created, out of which a member of the House of Hashemi, the Hashemites, gets put on the throne in Iraq. You get the peacock throne established in Persia. You get Syria and Lebanon established within the French zone of influence, which again had next to nothing to do with the realities. And then Britain gets Palestine and Egypt, I think. And then the Young Turks, meanwhile, were Kemal Ataturk and that gang were establishing an attempt at a modern European style democracy in Turkey. And it's been from the moment of the drawing of those early 20th century arbitrary lines, it's been nothing but trouble. I mean, Saddam Hussein arose in Iraq out of the guy that he wound up bumping off, who in turn had bumped off, had bumped the Iraqi king off of his throne. Because none of it worked. I guess, Bill, that's the thing for us to understand. None of this has ever worked. The system itself has been broken from its origins.
Well, the one thing about you and I, Bob, we seem to look at 1914 as a real arrow or a real roadmap or a real divide.
Well, you know, I saw something over this weekend that you would have appreciated. I understand you, of course, have visual challenges, but I'll tell you the story nonetheless. A performance artist arrived in Birmingham, England, and on this anniversary of the beginning of the Great Slaughter, she brought with her 5,000 little anthropomorphic sculptures of human beings.
Yep.
And they placed those 5,000 little sculptures on the steps of this central plaza in Birmingham. And they simply let the 5,000 melt in the sun. And they represented 5,000 British soldiers who never came home in 1914.
Yep. Well, which country, it was Iran that elected some guy to be prime minister, and we helped knock him off.
Oh, yeah, that's Mossadegh, Mohammad Mossadegh.
Mohammad Mossadegh, yeah.
Yeah, I vaguely remember when it happened. Yeah, he's part of the great Second World War upheaval of democracy by former colonies that actually took the allies seriously in all that they were talking about fighting for freedom against fascism.
Freedom, yeah.
So when the Second World War was over, they said, hey, how about a little bit of that freedom for us?
Well, who showed up in Versailles? The Vietnamese leader, Ho Chi Minh, showed up in Versailles.
Yeah, yeah, how about us? Oh, no. Yeah. We need rubber trees, Ho.
Yeah. Rubber, tin. Yeah. Yeah, we need this.
No, there's a great upwelling of liberation yearnings, freedom yearnings, all around the world in the wake of the Second World War. Harry S. Truman was very sympathetic to those urges. That's why he turned down De Gaulle and Churchill when they petitioned him for intervention in what was then known as French Indochina and Persia.
Well, even Ike wouldn't go in there in 54 to launch a massive air raid around D&D.
No, but Ike gave in to Churchill, and that's how that was the first great CIA success, was toppling Mossadegh.
Yeah.
And putting Reza Pahlavi on the, we learned about that, the peacock throne.
Yeah.
Because remember, at the time of the Persian Empire, the state religion was Zoroastrianism.
Yes.
And one of the several elements of the Yazidi faith is Zoroastrianism.
Who was the American general in the first Iraq war? Schwarzkopf. Yeah, his father was active.
Yes.
In Iran.
Exactly. Yeah. In that.
And
in that
also, by the way, he also was in on the Lindbergh kidnapping. He was with the
FBI in New Jersey.
New Jersey.
Or was
yeah,
it New
I think
Jersey
it was
State
New
Police?
Jersey, yeah. It's just funny how the people keep popping up. I just don't know what. I mean, my feeling is that the people that had come into Iraq, they're trouble. They're real trouble, too. And I guess you have to stand back and let them kill each other and watch.
There are options. The question is, do the American people have the stomach for it? I'm anti-war, so I'm not going to support it. Stand by.
Well, I have the unfortunate habit of looking back and saying, well, there were times that, well, Jim and I would talk about secession. And what was the thing to do in 1860 or 61? Was it to just let the country divide in two places and allow slavery to keep existing?
No, that was intolerable, and Lincoln knew it. If you wanted to deal with this, and the thing is, if the United States does send ground troops in, and remember the Powell Doctrine. Sorry, I'm sneezing. Hold on. Been hit by a sneezing bout. The Powell Doctrine. Doctrine says that you have to go in with overwhelming force. And it's not really the Powell Doctrine. That's any decent general that's ever fielded an army. But we're going in with air power alone, and air power will not do it by itself.
Oh, no. Well, unfortunately. Hey, the American Air Force thought it was going to do it in Korea.
And so, Barack Obama, President Obama, said over the weekend, you know, this may be a long engagement in terms of using air power to blah, blah, blah. Well,
and the Republicans keep changing their tunes. The Republicans are laying out two tunes and they're dancing to both of them. Two.
and it's a hell of a thing to behold, too, isn't it?
Oh.
Well. They can't decide if he goes with air power. But the thing is, the Republicans have the best of all possible worlds in a sort of Voltaire-like scenario, because if Barack Obama goes in with air power alone, they scream, we need boots on the ground. If he goes in with boots on the ground, they scream, oh, no, look, he's embroiling us in a foreign controversy.
Yep. They want to say they can't lose. But Bob, I was unfortunately...
Well, they want their cake. They want to have their cake and eat it, too, Bill. And You know, I think there's a remedy for people like that if history is to be
I met a lot of the Birch Society people in the 60s and heard their song and dance. And I didn't like their song and dance because I thought that you can't keep fighting wars. Just can't. Well, I'll make room for somebody else, but yeah, you, I have so much respect for your, and that's so funny when they were doing the mining in Belgium, you pray, the underground war that was going on, Scottish coal miners and Welsh coal miners versus Central European coal miners. You guys didn't have a miserable enough job, but you're supposed to go down there underground and dig tunnels and blow mines, and if you broke into the other guys,
I always love the line that John Sayles put in the mouth of the labor organizer in his magnificent movie, Mate One. On the First World War, he said, all I seen was workers killing workers.
Yep. I've been working on books by Studs Terkel. And my God, you know, I've forgotten so much of that stuff and what things were like then. It's like, that was my youth. And by the, and the truth is, youth was tied up with love, marriage, music, trying to survive, trying to get ahead. And a lot of that stuff just slipped right by me. I was never, I didn't like Mork and Mindy too much as a television show, but the more I saw Robin Williams in the movie situation, the better he was.
Well,
you knew
you were in the presence of genius in terms of his comedy.
Yeah. Mork, he was.
And you know, Mork and Mindy was silly, but
yep.
When you realize that 90% of what the man was doing on camera was ad lib, you knew that the mind behind it was just razor sharp.
Quick.
And, quick as a lick.
Well, I was blessed by old-time radio. A guy like Benny had his cast and his, his program. And of course, even the old, Black Amos and Andy, the leading comics, the guys who were comedians were good. The guy that played Kingfish, he had funny mannerisms. And of course, Red Fox did the same thing, only what Fox did, he improved it. Everybody on the show, black, white, Puerto Rican, anybody. I remember one time he was doing business with a bunch of Japanese guys who wanted to buy the junkyard. They ended up being fun poke to them too. Because frankly, in the long run, that's
no one
the
was no one was safe from Red Fox.
No, that of course you remember the early Red Fox records.
Oh, you
remember
sure.
Any of those?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean that was the mark of cool. You know, red. Well, in my era, it was Red Fox 8-track tapes.
Yep. Yeah, because that was you were when I was a young kid in the 8th and 9th grade. That was very risque stuff, Bob. And that's important at that age, you know.
Oh,
anyway,
yeah.
I'll let you go, man.
All right, Bill, you have a good evening. Good talking to you.
Somebody else put that on here. Take care.
All right. Bye now. Our good buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. I saw Tracy trying to get in a few minutes ago. If you're still listening, Tracy, the line's open now. And just periodically, it's probably good for me to remind folks that we're operating on one phone line now. So if somebody's on, that means you got to wait. And that number is 304-574-8178 or Skype to Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. Yeah, just a couple of little clips from Robin Williams by way of Memento Mori.
Huddle up. Huddle up! We don't read and write poetry because it's cute. We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race. And the human race is filled with passion. Medicine, law, business, engineering, these are noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life. But poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for. To quote from Whitman, O me, O life, of the questions of these recurring, of the endless trains of the faithless, of cities filled with the foolish, what good amid these, O me, O life? Answer, that you are here, that life exists and identity, that the powerful play goes on and you may contribute a verse. That the powerful play goes on and you may contribute a verse. What will your verse be?
That's the serious stuff. And then there's this. Oh, then there's this.
Chuck, Cam, great to see you. Yo, yo, what's up, Wales? House of Windsor, keeping it real. Obama, yeah! Yes, indeed, yeah! The dream came true. Great God Almighty, the dream came true. Obama, Obama, Obama! Obama, yeah! Barack, which means blessing. Hussein, don't ask. Obama, which is an old Kenyan word for Kennedy, God bless us. And a lot of Irish people are going, he's black Irish, he's an Obama. But he is an eloquent, eloquent man. I know at the inauguration people are hoping that maybe he kicks it up a notch going, what's up, Washington? Yo, 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 let's keep it real right now. I'm going to bring out the members of my political posse, my cabinet right now. This is little Ray Ray. This is G-Man, Kanye, Kobe, and Colin Powell, who's bad to the bone. We're going down Pennsylvania Avenue with the top down. We're going to build a basketball court in the Rose Garden. But we do have to take a moment of silence and bid a fond farewell to George W. Bush. Yes, it's the end of the reign of George II. The reign of error is over. America is officially out of rehab. Welcome. We have come back. Thank you. He is a gift to comedy, though. He is a comedy pinata. I'm going to miss him. A man who said, I'm the decider. No, sir, you're the president. You make decisions. Decider is what they sell in the little jugs. A lot of people... He also said, I am misunderstimated. And I went, no, not really. And you think, what is he going to do after he leaves office? No, he cannot go on a speaking tour. That's a given. But I do think he could do stand-up comedy because he has 8 years of amazing material. He has stuff, and here's some of W's greatest hits. The question that's never asked, is our children learning? I just found out that a lot of our imports come from other countries. America, a country where you can put food on your family. Our enemies are looking for terrible ways to destroy this country, and so are we. And you have to have a little sympathy, though. W comes from a family where the smart brother is named Jeb. So you have to kind of... Take a moment, just have a little moment of silence. And you can't blame the economy on him. They say the economy is essentially sound because people are considering buying things. That's like saying fat people are healthy because they might exercise. But no, we need help. We went to the world. I like the fact the American government went all around the world and the French were going, I feel so bad for you, huh? Sad, yeah. thing are worth $750 billion they can spare. And I'm going, the only people in the world, the Saudis. The Saudi, can you spare I will give you $750 billion. All I want is a picture of Angelina Jolie and Louis Walsh. I changed that reference for England. Thank God that worked. Thank you. But it was the economy, the whole thing, and the whole debate. Basically, it was we had Obama, Fresh Prince, McCain, Uncle Fester on the Adams family. And the debates were so amazing. The first debate, two people speaking in complete sentences after 8 years of W. I was going, thank you, God! I was beginning to think our electoral process was like the Special Olympics of politics. I was like, no! The second debate, McCain started to get a little like, that one. And then the third debate, oh, wow, McCain was just like, he starts to look like your uncle who's on a new drug and he hasn't got the dosage right. And you find him wandering around the mall. But I've got a plan! I know where Osama is. Tell us. I'm not going to tell you yet. Where's the plumber? Where's Joe? Where's the plumber? Get in the car, Uncle John. Get in the car. But it was pretty wild, that whole concept. What is he doing there? And I was like, and where? Where did they get Sarah Palin? Where did they find her? Wow! Did Ronald Reagan have a kid with Posh Spice? I don't know. But, gee. It's like she came from some sort of reality show. Project Running Mate. Here she comes. Here comes Sarah. Her hobbies are breastfeeding and helicopter hunting. She could skin a moose and balance a budget. Come on down. With that shucks and all kind of, oh, my gosh, oh, shucks. Polar bears are not endangered. They're just unlucky. Come on. It was pretty amazing, too. The last few days of the election, she let her hair down. She took her glasses off. I thought the last day she'd just be like, check it out. How do you like my northern slopes now, boys? Drill, baby, drill, drill. You think Bill Clinton was sitting at home the whole time going, where was she when I was in office? And Bill has some bad luck. He found the only Jewish girl who couldn't get a stain out. That is so sad. But the whole thing is, American politics are always crazy. I live in California. We're a 60% Hispanic state. We have an Austrian governor. Even old Nazis are going, that's weird. That is not right. And Arnold could be president. If it wasn't for that tiny clause, if you're not born in America, you can't run for president. Arnold, the little immigrant boy who had a dream and a vial of anabolic steroids. And he lives with and married to Maria Shriver, who's a Kennedy, who's getting smaller and smaller. I believe he's living off of her. I believe he's sucking the Kennedy out of her slowly but surely. And that's why he's become a moderate Republican, which is kind of cool. It's like a Volvo with a gun rack. You don't see a lot of it. But I was thinking, maybe there's one person, and I want to get a guy out there running, you know, and Sarah and people talk, who can we get that would run and make the whole world go, wow? And that guy would be Jack Nicholson. Yeah, baby. He has got cooler movies than Arnold. You can't handle the truth. We'll never have a sex scandal with Jack. He's done everybody. I had Angelina Jolie, and afterwards she adopted me. And you'll never have a drug scandal. Jack has done every drug known to mankind. He's the only guy in the world that Keith Richards will go, I have to go home now, Jack. But I'll leave you right now because some people say that I look like Bono, and I have to say, stop drinking. But recently, Bono was on stage in Scotland, and it was very quiet, like right now. And he started clapping his hands, and he clapped his hands, and he said, every time I clap my hands, a child in Africa dies. And from the back of the Scottish audience, someone went, then stop clapping your hands! Good night, thank you, sir!
Oh, God, he will be missed. Stop clapping your hands! Jim, noting Dead Poets Society, one of his best, R.I.P., Requiescat in Pace. Marty noting, sadly, something broke Mr. Keating's spirit, like Neil Perry's father broke his son's spirit to where he took his own life in that movie. Sadly, says Marty, no more images of Robin Williams at AT&T Park in a Giants cap. Yes, he was a Giants fan. I just had a note from Sparky saying, post the link, please. All I did was, I went to YouTube and just said, Robin Williams, stand up, and all that. God, you'll be busy all night. I think that last clip was called Robin Williams Destroys George Bush. If only. If only. So it's 28 minutes before the hour. Ah, that explains it. Tracy's phone is dead, so she can't call in. Oh, damn. Sorry about that, Tracy. Tomorrow? Yeah. Hopefully. Note coming in from Steve in China. Subject line, diplomacy. With regard to America's woeful lack of diplomatic acumen vis-a-vis the European powers, since when does a world-class breaker of treaties and destroyer of a continent's worth of indigenous peoples need to know more about diplomacy or the drawing up of boundaries than the working end of a gun barrel or the crude language of oil and dollar bills? Just saying. By the way, Did I? Thank you. Thank you, Steve. That's profoundly put. Joseph noting via Twitter, how I miss Robin Williams already. Yeah. The New York Times notice of his passing said that he had been struggling with depression of late. I get the idea that he struggled with it all along. He also struggled, as TMZ noted, with various forms of self-medication. Don't say that somebody struggled with cocaine and alcohol. There was no struggle. And that's, I'm not being disrespectful to Robin Williams' memory. There was no struggle. The struggle was with that which necessitated the recourse to drugs and alcohol. For some, it is a recreation, a relief, a pleasant diversion. I've read those anthropologists who say, And not just anthropologists, but zoologists, who say that very few land-based animals don't find some way to get effed up if they get the opportunity. But for others, well, I mean, take a person who suffers from depression. Now give them a few cocktails. Hello? Alcohol is a depressant, not a stimulant. And so consequently, what may feel great on the front end is going to be living hell on the back end. It was Robin Williams himself who said, the problem with cocaine is that it makes you feel like a new man. Only 30 minutes later, the new man wants a line too. So don't say that he struggled with drugs and alcohol. The struggle was with himself, in himself. As it is for one and all of us, some of us simply struggle differently.
more or less successfully. That bit that he did that you just heard where he just, well, he destroyed George W. Bush. God, is it any, did he ever do one of those White House correspondence dinners as the featured act during the dim leader misadministration? I don't think so. Because he would have eaten George alive. There would have been nothing left there but a little greasy spot. But, the tales are legion. Whether it's Robin Williams or Richard Burton or... Richard Harris or... Jim was just talking a little bit ago about Lawrence of Arabia. Peter O'Toole, that's who I'm trying to think of. Those guys were legendary for their drinking bouts. And they, not making excuses, but when you go out on the boards for some people, and you ratchet your entire being up to the absolute nth degree, every nerve ending in your being just sticking out of your skin. And then the performance is over and you walk off stage and say, well, okay, I'll be normal now. Can't be done. Got to be some kind of release. Some people find that in booze, some in drugs, some in Tai Chi. I just can't imagine Robin Williams or Richard Harris or Peter O'Toole or Richard Burton getting off stage and going and, you know, clapping hands to inquire of Buddha. Nice line, Jim. Alcohol can do more for man to justify the ways of God to man than Milton can. Yes, indeed. We have $20 to go on Paul from Parts Unknown's challenge for the evening. That's $20 to go to get doubled. Your 5 becomes 10, your 10 becomes 20, etc. Had a tweet earlier from Haley. And I don't think we can just blow right past this. Because it sort of dovetails with the beginning of the program. Remember the lady who called in to Rush Limb... Rush Mega Dittos from South Carolina, Stan. I just wanted to thank you for your book. We're destroying the minds of the little youngins down here in the third grade in South Carolina by reading to them from your OxyContin-fueled writings. Well, as we roll downhill toward the end of the program, enter Kevin Swanson. A Christian fundy, who has some sort of radio program, I guess, on which he had as a guest an individual by the name of Walter Kennedy. This was last month. It has just come to light. The folks at Right Wing Watch can only monitor so much weirdness at one time, and
Sometimes they go back in the stacks and go, hey, we missed one. So, Walter Kennedy is a neo-Confederate. Kevin Swanson is a weirdo. I think this is our first duct tape and hockey puck warning for the evening. And it's serious. One of the things the right wing is apparently fond of doing these days is redefining the whole of American history. Rush Limbaugh has redefined the Pilgrims as little baby Rockefellers landing on the shores of North America to establish the free market. Pastor John Starve Hagee is out there, as Edward tells us, quoting Lenin. Yeah. Enter Kevin Swanson in dialogue with Walter Kennedy. Who's Walter Kennedy? Well, Right Wing Watch would have you know that he has argued, among other things, that the Disney movie Frozen, which I kind of like because it has apparently empowered a whole lot of little girls, because it's got this take no BS anthem in it called Let It Go. Let's see. I've seen my granddaughter sing Let It Go, and I've seen Molly Malloy sing Let It Go, and today I saw another little girl singing Let It Go, and I mean they pour all the passion of their hopes and dreams into that song. Well, Frozen, according to Kevin Swanson, is evil, just evil. He continued, I wonder if people are thinking, you know, I think this cute little movie is going to indoctrinate my 5-year-old to be a lesbian or treat homosexuality or bestiality in a light sort of way. I wonder if the average parent going to see Frozen is thinking that way. I wonder if they're just walking in and saying, yeah, let's get my 5-year-old and 7-year-old indoctrinated early. He said there's something very evil about that movie. If I was the devil, what would I do to really foul up an entire social system and do something really, really, really evil to 5- and 6- and 7-year-olds in Christian families around America? I'd make a movie. I'd buy Disney. If I was the devil, I would buy Disney in 1984. That's what I would have done. No, see, I wouldn't do that, Kevin. If I was the devil, I would send preachers into churches who would rape little children. That's how you really screw them up, Kevin Swanson. But we're not talking about kids here. No. We're reinterpreting American history. Yeah, actually, we're just kind of remaking it wholesale. Hey, go ahead, guys. Really, I'm not kidding. Duct tape, hockey puck.
The world tends to move from slavery form A to slavery form B. You say, well, then we're just going from slavery to slavery. Yeah, human nature in...
Okay, wait. Let's work through this. The world tends to go from slavery form A to slavery form B. It's not an upward progression. It's downward. It degrades so that the slavery, and I'm not in any way excusing it, because it could be every bit as brutal as anything that was practiced on the North American continent, but the slavery of the ancient world was one in which people could sell themselves into slavery so as to go and make more money than they were making as free people. Ancient Greek pedagogues were one such instance. Pedagogues, please. They would sell themselves into slavery be purchased by some noble Roman's household. And the next thing you know, they're running a little school and teaching decent Greek to little Roman boys and occasionally girls and making money for it. And then they buy their freedom back and they retire to a life in the country. Call that slavery A. Actually, that would be slavery B. Slavery A is in the Bible. And the ancient, even more ancient world generally. So, cross the Atlantic and you degrade to slavery C, where there's no such opportunity for advancement at all, and people are simply worked to death. Because free market, because Jesus, because, well, there's not nearly enough of us white people and we don't want to do it in the first place. But I don't think that's what Kevin Swanson is actually talking about.
And Walter Williams, the instructor from his Grove City College, African-American man who's done some good work in economics, he talks about how the African-Americans here in America moved from the local fiefdoms off to the federal plantations. I think Thomas Sowell speaks of the same thing. But again, that's what I'm talking about. We move from slavery form to slavery.
Wait, what? What? No.
Slavery form. It's the socialist utopia.
Damn it. Stand by. There we go.
Man who's done some good work in economics. He talks about how the African Americans here in America moved from the local fiefdoms off to the federal plantations.
What, Edith, huh?
He's talking about after the end of the Civil War. And no, Kevin Swanson, it's a fiefdom, not a fiefdom. God damn, what do you think? Barney was running them? To the federal plantation. What federal plantation? Is the federal plantation right next door to the FEMA Obama re-education camp? Probably, at least in the fever swamp of this guy's brain.
I think Thomas Sowell speaks of the same thing. But again, that's what I'm talking about. We move from slavery form to slavery form. And it's the socialist utopians that come into town. And they promised deliverance from local fiefdoms only to create a larger tyranny in the Soviet Union and the Soviet America, Soviet China, and Soviet everywhere else in the world. So just keep that in mind. That these great and grand socialist utopians come into town and say, sell you a bill of goods. We'll deliver you from slavery form A to slavery form B. And that happens a lot to people who don't understand that it's Christ who sets us free.
Okay. Anybody know where the really big butterfly net and the purple crayon is in the straitjacket? And the Thorazine dart gun? Now, we don't have the rest of the clip, but it's apparently a real Lulu. Because this Walter Kennedy character then opines that Abraham Lincoln gave a big boost to communism by winning the Civil War. And that the federal government that won the Civil War, the Union, then and it created a, quote, incessant attack on religious values in America. Really? The president who called for a national day of thanksgiving to the Almighty was a commie. Lincoln was a Marxist dictator. An incessant attack on religious values in America. Kennedy then proceeds, what Marxist dictator could ask for less? All of these communists that have wormed their way into power, into powerful positions, they begin to influence other people to pursue this objective of a big, indivisible government, and government supplants God as being sovereign. Post-Civil War, you've got the socialist goals, the communist platform, the manifesto platform. I think there are 10 elements to the platform. One by one, they come about in our country. And first was the public schools. They want all the children to think alike. And what tyrant doesn't want all of his subjects to think alike? Huh? What? What? Huh? No, really.
Post-Appomattox, we're being taught that government always trumps anything else. It's supreme. But that's not the way America should be.
You just knew he'd have that accent, don't you? Didn't you? Neo-Confederate Walter Kennedy Lincoln was a commie scholar. Yeah, you know he wasn't going to come on talking like, no.
America should be a freedom-based society, a liberty-based society, where liberty always trumps government. Or else we're being un-American.
Wolverines! Add to.
Well, post-Civil War, you've got the socialist goals, the communist platform, the manifesto platform. I think there are 10 elements to the platform. One by one, they come up about in our country. I bring that out in my book, Apostate. But first was the public schools.
Right.
And, of course, we're dealing with Common Core today, the imposition of Washington's agenda on every single district across America. But it began with the Morrill Land Grant Act, and that authorized federal agents to establish federal government-controlled education. That
was the stupid, it burns us. He is talking about the Morrill Act, or Morrell, M-O-R-R-E-L-L, passed in 1862 during the Civil War, once we had finally gotten the aristocrats and the slave owners out of the Congress. They tried to pass it prior to the Civil War, land-grant universities, a recognition by a still fairly, a still largely rural country that didn't have much in the way of higher education or scientific experimentation or research or institutions to do those things, that maybe it would be good for each and every state to have a university in it. And the way... Well, there are some objections with the Morrill Act. The way you do it is that you sell off land that doesn't have people on it, except that it does, and you use the proceeds from the sale of the land that doesn't have people on it, except that it does, to finance the building of the universities. I graduated from a land-grant university. Harvard on the Mon. West Virginia University. One of my goals one of these days is to go out and find that little hunk of ground in Iowa that whose sale by the federal government supported the creation of my alma mater. There will be apologies due. But that's what he's talking about. He's talking about the Morrill Act. I don't know if it's Morrill or Morrill. I'm just switching back either way, interchangeably. Holy crap.
Such a big step. When did that happen, the Land Grant Act?
That was, if I remember correctly, in the midst of the war between the states.
Okay.
You'll notice it's the war between the states with this neo-Confederate asshat. I'm surprised he doesn't call it the War of Northern Aggression.
And again, Morrell, that was the same guy that wanted the high tariff. He was a radical Republican, and he was wanting to use the power of the government to promote his objectives. And one of the objectives that they wanted to do was to remold the education in the United States to make all the children think alike.
No. They didn't want to remold education. There was no education, except for the children of the wealthy and those occasional rubbish who would get raked, as Thomas Jefferson described it. Really? And they wanted all the children to think alike. You know, say, not thinking that slavery was a good idea. That kind of thinking alike. Oh, by the way, Mississippi State University, land-grant institution. Auburn University, land-grant institution. Mm-hmm, sure. Louisiana State, mm-hmm, I think so. University of, Oklahoma University, yep. University of Missouri, mm-hmm. See how it goes? Now, for instance, the University of Alabama, not a land-grant university. University of North Carolina, University of Georgia, not land-grant universities. Don't think the University of Tennessee is either. Those were formed for the, and when they were formed, they were tiny little institutions that were formed for the education of the wealthy planter class, regardless of what it was they were planting, be it, well, University of Virginia. Harvard and William and Mary, the two oldest schools in the United States, were founded as educational institutions for treating, creating and training gospel sharps. Princeton, too. Preacher teaching schools. Because we weren't much weren't nearly as interested in teaching children to read and reason at that time as we were in teaching children to blindly follow religious tenets, which is, you know, the thing that gets, you know, the Walter Kennedys and Kevin Swansons all tingly. Idiots. But it's too dismissive just to call them idiots. These people are actually engaged in trying to undo every last bit of progress ever made in this country. By golly, Anatole, in the chat room, you spell it right. IDJITS, idiots. You know it. Thanks, Linda, by the way. Thanks going out to Linda, who finished off Paul from Parts Unknown's birthday challenge for this evening. There will be another one tomorrow and one on Wednesday. Thank you, Paul, and thank you to everyone who answered that challenge. And thank you to Margaret as well over the weekend, who helped keep us going. Thank you very kindly. Time to get out of here. We'll be back for Titanic Tuesday tomorrow evening. Hope you'll join us then. And by us, I mean the Horn Family Commune Congregation. Had a great lot of fun in the chat room this evening. I watch. I don't always get to comment, but I watch. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy, moderators in the Horn chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you, John Fox. I think he's got a new drum to bang on down in Australia. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACACT, ACHEACT.ORG, ACACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.